You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is where we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines around our region this week. And joining us live in studio today, Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television, George Prentice with the Boise Weekly, and Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press of Idaho. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Gemma.
Hello.
So, you know, we don't always like to start right in Boise because Idaho is bigger than Boise. However, we have a mayoral race going on and an interesting little twist with a city council member throwing her hat in the ring, Lauren McLean. And Bill, you are nodding your head. This is kind of fascinating, to say the least.
Well, you know, I got to thinking about that. When was the last time that we had a mayoral race with this kind of headline power? And, you know, Jim Tibbs, who was a sitting city council member in 2007, ran against Beter, former chief of police, and lost and went on to become a county commissioner. And, of course, there was this big four-way race that Beter first won in 2003. But I have to say, this race with these stakes, with somebody as polished and sophisticated and as organized and smart as Lauren McLean, this is going to be the most interesting mayoral race, I think, in Beter's time there.
I agree. I was dusting off my old interviews with Lauren McLean, and the one I found just before she was sworn in was she thought the hardest part of her job, and it was a quote, having my name printed in the paper. But her evolution, if you will, her political evolution is tangible. And if you look, for instance, to 2012, when she worked very closely with Marianne Jordan to put together Add the Words and an ordinance for the city of Boise, I don't think anyone disputes her resume when it comes to Foothills protection, et cetera. She's a fascinating person. Yes, she has voted almost lockstep with the mayor for the last several years, but her candidacy will be defined on how she separates herself from Beter.
That, to me, is the most interesting part of this. I don't think you could probably get a slip of paper between them politically as far as the issues between Beter and Lauren. But if you read her announcement, it was all about approach and style and temperament. It was not about the issues. It was about listening. It was about transparency. At one point, she says, we have to put aside our old grudges. So she didn't name the sitting mayor specifically, but this was aimed at him and his style of I think people would say Beter knows best. Mm-hmm. And she is offering something different. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be really interesting.
All that said, his chances improve the more people are added to that ballot.
That is true.
In other words, it's the anti-Beter versus Beter.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you have two other folks whose names I don't remember running. So right now the field is reasonably crowded and I suppose could get more crowded.
Yep.
The other thing that strikes me is, and we've talked about it on this show multiple times over the year, is that there's something happening in Boise right now, right? There is this sense of unsettlement. It's growth, it's change, it's money, it's housing, it's transportation, it's congestion. And I think this isn't left or right or D versus R. It's about people who are excited and eager about all this change and people who are really uncomfortable with all this change. And I think all of us have that sense that Boise's on this cusp and we're not exactly sure where we're going. And I think that is underlying this whole moment.
Well, and then getting back to the point of what you said, Bill, about how Lauren McLean has voted in the past, right? And her issues being very similar to Dave Beter's. There was an article in the Idaho Press, I believe, about a week or so ago that looked at the voting record of the Boise City Council and the fact that, what, 9 times out of 10, even more than
95% plus.
Yeah. That they've all
unanimous.
Unanimous.
Yeah. Right, right. This isn't about the issues, and it isn't about the politics, right? It's about something else that's going on. Before I read about Lauren's announcement, I was reading a story in the Washington Post about San Francisco, and it talked about how that town is broken. And it's all the wealth that has plowed into San Francisco that has made it unlivable for anybody except the richest people. And there's this quote, and I want to read it to you. The city is losing the very things that people move to the city for. And I thought, that's what's happening in Boise.
Right.
Now, we're not San Francisco. We don't have billionaires, you know, cashing in their IPOs. But nonetheless, people see the town changing so quickly and so dramatically. And I think there's a lot of people who are uncomfortable and unsettled about where we're headed.
But then the question goes to how much power does a mayor actually have? Because it is the city council, right? So where does that ultimately play into voting power?
So it strikes me that of all the things people see around them, the apartments, the condos, all the hotels, the change on campus, you know, all the stuff happening. Well, what do people actually have some say about? They have a say about who is elected to the mm-hmm. city council. They have a say about whether their money goes to a stadium or to a library. So in some ways, these issues that we're seeing right now about a vote for the stadium, a vote for the library, a vote on CCDC stuff, I think it's almost a proxy, right? It's the one way people can kind of get a handle on all this other stuff that's kind of out of our control.
Right. It is going to be interesting. And I think it makes the race at least a talker and will be on people's radar, where in the past, maybe not, right?
I think you're right. Yeah. And several council races that are shaping up as well. So this could mm-hmm. be a really interesting election. And you
filing doesn't even start till August.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about voting. And because we had an election that happened earlier this week. Now, in Canyon County, this was the fourth attempt since 2006, I believe, to pass a bond for a new jail. It failed. And it didn't fail a little bit. It failed with flying colors.
Yeah, they needed 2/3 and they got
one third. Right?
Yeah. Well, you look at what happened in Canyon County. You look what happened at CWI. You look what happened with the ACHD fee. Except for the school districts who seem to have pretty good luck getting their levies passed, voters seem to be really skeptical about any kind of government spending these days. And I'm not sure that I can put my finger on what's going on there, but it certainly seems to be a trend.
But it's certainly also about messaging. And the Boise School District is probably a great example of getting what they ask for. And what they've proven is they're really skilled at messaging and being very detailed. And I think the number one criticism for this bond issue was, okay, but you haven't addressed the operational budget. It's like, why does it have to be this big? There wasn't much detail in the messaging.
But even the school districts outside of Boise have had pretty good luck getting levies and supplemental money, as opposed to other local governments that seem to be really struggling. So something's going on there, and I would like to know more.
It was telling just to see how much it failed by. I think there's the question. Why did it fail so dramatically?
You're looking at the wrong person.
Exactly.
I have no idea. I know that, this has been an issue. It's gotten lots of ink over the years, escapes of those inmates from those tents. This mm-hmm. is not something people are unfamiliar with, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's stay on the jail prison theme here. Rebecca, fallout from an Idaho inmate death. This was earlier this year, but at a private prison outside of the state of Idaho.
Right.
I mean, it was an Idaho inmate, but being housed at a private prison.
Yes. And so I think George actually wrote a great story on that recently where you really went into a lot of detail.
Yeah. So we started where everyone started, and that was we knew an inmate died at the private prison owned and operated by GEO near the Texas-Mexico border, and he died, and the official word was of natural causes. Okay, can we see the autopsy? There was no autopsy, and that's where we began. Mm. And what we learned was a major failure of health services, and two separate independent audits were conducted at that facility, and that facility failed miserably. We learned that the doctor, a head of health services, was fired. We heard that the attending nurse was fired. We learned that the survivors, the relatives of the inmate who died, had a private meeting with Governor Little where he apologized and said, I promise this won't happen again. We have also learned that the family has contacted the nation's number one attorney when it comes to lawsuits in regards to prison deaths. And he's out of a Seattle firm. And I spoke to him and he said, you bet, I'm at the investigatory stage.
Wow.
So, and I think we've seen a movie like this before when it comes to private prisons.
Right. And this is not the first time this has happened in Idaho. I mean, we've lost prisoners from out-of-state prisons, privately run prisons, before. In 2007, Scott Noble Payne committed suicide, and the investigation, subsequent investigation into his death revealed that GEO Group prison was absolutely squalid. It was just the conditions there were horrific. And then a year later at a different GEO Group prison, we had another inmate, Randall McCullough, commit suicide after spending like months and months and months in solitary confinement at this facility. That's part of what back then prompted Idaho to bring help, you know, to hurry up and get all of its inmates back home. But overseeing private prisons from afar, especially, I mean, it's been difficult for Idaho to do in Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
But overseeing private prisons from afar is a very complicated prospect.
So how does this fall into, because wasn't it earlier this year or late last year when there were some family members who had family incarcerated in a private prison down near the Texas border, and they contacted media saying like that these are not good conditions. And then lawmakers went down, Idaho lawmakers went down and said, hey, everything's hunky-dory.
Senator Rice said it had a new prison smell.
I don't ever need to smell that, whatever that is.
He said, I've been around a lot of prisons, and he told me it has a new prison smell. But in fact, we know that that roof leaked. The facilities were not available. Inmates did not have access to outdoors for, I think, up to 60 days. And this is when they first were moved there. So here we are. But you've been reporting that we're not moving away from private prisons anytime soon or out of state placement. And just this week, right, the Board of Correction?
Right, yeah. They've approved their RFP, which is a request for proposal for
an extension
of keeping it, well, not necessarily with this group, but keeping these inmates out of state for a longer period of time because there's just no room for them in Idaho. And there's not currently, at least, any political will to build a new prison here. And there doesn't seem to be much political will to reduce. I mean, there has been some efforts to reduce the numbers of people we are actually incarcerating. But Idaho has a really high incarceration rate for our compared to our crime rate, compared to our neighbors and in many other states in the U.S. So, you got prisoners, you got to keep them somewhere.
Right. So you take them out of state in the situation that we're in. Mm-hmm. How does then, Rebecca, public records from prisons, how does this play into that potentially? Why is this important to me to be able to get these public records? Because this has been something we've talked about on the program as well, basically this lack of transparency.
Right. So, you know, really, public records from prisons, as obtained by the media and is shared with the general public, is often the only glimpse that the general public gets into a prison, unless they have a loved one there or they go there themselves, right, or they work there. So these public records can be vitally important to being able to cover and understand the prison system and letting the public make decisions about how they want their prison system run through the process of elections, right? Well, on Monday, the Idaho Board of Correction met. And what they did is they tightened and clarified some restrictions on what documents they believe can be released under the Public Records Act. Now, our Public Records Act gives the board some discretion that there's really not any other agencies have that kind of discretion to decide what they can release and what they can't. And it's for some fairly narrowly defined categories. But when the board, you know, when the entity that's deciding can do its own deciding, there's an argument to be said. You know, they get to decide how narrow or broadly that is defined. So, you know, the security of a prison. So, like, they're not going to release the blueprints so somebody can figure out how to tunnel out of there. Not that people tunnel out of prisons these days, but you know what I'm saying.
Somebody might try.
Well, they might try. Or, you know, shut down the power or whatnot. There are things like that that really implicate the security or safety or their ability to carry out their operations. Well, they were talking about, they wanted to define exactly what some of these things, not all of them, are so that the board would be consistent in how it interpreted. Because Idaho Department of Correction Director Josh DeWalt said, you know, that we've been inconsistent in the past on whether we've released these or not or how we've interpreted this statute. So they talked about potentially limiting security camera footage from being released. Now, security camera footage has had a big impact on Idaho news coverage of prisons in the past. It, you know, there was the video I obtained a few years ago of an inmate, Hani Al-Abed, being beaten to the point of brain damage by another inmate who beat him for so long, they actually stopped and like sat down and took a break for a while guards watched and then got up and resumed the beating. This was at what was then a CCA, now called Core Civic, privately run prison in Idaho. There's been other instances like that in the past where different news organizations have obtained video security footage, and it's gone on to make changes. The coverage of that has gone on to prompt changes within the prison mm-hmm. system. The board decided against that, decided against spelling it out in their board minutes, right, in their internal documentation. Mm-hmm. However, they did make it clear that it's their policy basically to always refuse those records requests. What they did decide to remove or always keep exempt were the locations of security cameras and how many security cameras there are, things like that. Inmate visitor logs and visitor information, telephone logs, emails to inmates, trust account information, you know, like their mm-hmm. how much money they have, because they don't want the inmates to be extorted mm-hmm. by one another. And then offender GPS records and information.
But taking it back to quite simply an inmate death, don't you want to know where those cameras are? And were they capable of capturing that?
Right. And so the Department of Corrections says, look, we don't want people to triangulate and figure out where the blind spots are, because prisoners might be able to hide and attack a guard or attack another inmate or whatnot. But the other side of that argument is, if there are major blind spots within a facility, perhaps the public should know, so they could consider, you know, asking their lawmakers to invest more money mm-hmm. in security cameras or
just having the full picture
in the operation. So
we are continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable. My guest today, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press of Idaho, George Prentice with the Boise Weekly, and Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television. And Bill, it just wouldn't be a Reporter Roundtable with you if we didn't talk about hemp, marijuana. So we have three truck drivers. We have talked about this on the program. We had Representative Elena Rubel on last week, I believe, talking about these three drivers who were pulled over, ended up being arrested because they were hauling hemp interstate. There is a petition that went out asking that the Ada County Prosecuting Attorney's Office drops these charges.
Yeah, pretty remarkable that you have Idaho legislators going to bat for, you know, alleged criminals and alleged drug traffickers.
And we should say that even though we had Representative Rubel on, who is a Democrat, there are Republicans and conservative Republicans who are also asking for these charges to be dropped.
Well, you know, my standard disclaimer every time we talk about this is I'm interested in the policy and,
right.
not partaking. But nonetheless, this is a fascinating issue, and it goes back to what the legislature tried to do, you know, in the last session. There were several efforts to make this gray area away, right? To make hemp cultivation and by extension, transportation through the mm-hmm. state legal, so that we're not this kind of oddball state in this sea of legality. And so now you have legislators who are kind of carrying on that mission outside of the session, trying to show what an odd position our state is in because of our kind of adamancy mm-hmm. about prohibition.
And let's not forget the federal farm bill passed, which apparently when this last gentleman was taken into custody, the farm bill had already passed, but apparently there were certain aspects of it that they were still working out.
Right, the
farm. So he fell into this gray zone.
Right, the point behind the farm bill was to clarify that hemp cultivation, for its fiber and for its, you know, for its products, was legal in the United States. Idaho, nonetheless, wants to take a very careful position, you know, like Governor Little says, about anything that might be on the slippery slope to legalization. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, even the federal government under the Trump administration now is signaling that it should be okay to cultivate hemp, and we're in this strange place where we're not ready to go that far.
Well, and within this petition, I believe it was presented to the Ada County Prosecuting Attorney's Office. No charges have been dropped that we know of.
No, and so I don't know where it's going to go now. But you have legislators of both parties urging intervention means that it's not likely to go away.
And they're digging in their heels. The prosecutor sent out a statement saying they were bound to make these arrests. And Representative Rubel says, tell me what else you're bound by, mm-hmm. because there's a number of things that are against the law in Idaho. We don't see you arresting those folks.
Well, and to that point, we should make it clear, because a lot of times people don't understand this, is that prosecutors are the ones who bring the charges. They are the ones who have the power. It's not police. It's not investigators. it's not judges. And when it comes to things like mandatory minimums, which these charges are, judges cannot drop those charges. All of this lies in the hands of prosecutors.
Well, you know, the irony is that Idaho is such a pro-business, you know, pro-free enterprise, pro-independent state, pro-agriculture, right? What is it about this particular crop that's got these guys and gals so adamant? And I think we're going to continue to see this clash play out in press conferences and future legislative sessions.
Mm-hmm. So, Rebecca, there is a manhunt going on right now in southern Idaho. And I've read a little bit about this, but get us updated. There was a man who allegedly killed another man along I-84.
Right. So, and as far as I know, as of at least an hour ago, this man is still underway.
Right.
Right. So a man named Jonathan Yana or Lana, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but he's 45 years old. He's apparently from Los Angeles. He was driving. Police say he was driving through Utah, and they believe that he fired multiple shots at people driving in another car, killing the driver, injuring the passenger, and then continued on his way toward Idaho.
So this happened in Utah.
This happened in northern Utah on Interstate 84. Well, police in Idaho, you know, the APB went out. Police in Idaho think they see the vehicle. They give chase in near Cache County on Interstate 86 in southern Idaho. And eventually this car containing who they believe is a suspect crashes into a canal. The driver escapes on foot. So there has been. So the shooting happened Wednesday night. The search has continued all through Thursday. It's still going on this morning. They're basically searching the fields and farmland and, you know, high desert tundra of Cache County.
Well, and an alert went out this morning, I believe, too, saying that if you live in that area, lock your doors.
Yeah. So the Cache County Sheriff was warning people yesterday, you know, there are houses. It's sparsely populated, but people live out there saying, lock your doors. Do not pick up hitchhikers. I think they even had signs on the road saying, don't pick up hitchhikers. You know, let us know if there are any missing vehicles on your property.
Or any random people on your property.
Right, right. They don't actually know if the suspect is currently armed. They found a weapon in the vehicle. They don't know if that was the only weapon or if there were more.
And they don't know, any more about the why behind the killing of this individual? Or they just know it happened?
They have not said anything about what they believe the motive might be. So apparently there was a traffic slowdown. They have said there was a traffic slowdown that resulted when two big rigs passed each other and that the shooting occurred after that. So the Jetta and the Range Rover both managed to clear this traffic slowdown. And then a short time later, police say the shooting happened. So was it, we don't know if it was road rage, if it was something entirely different. There's just no idea. I mean, I'm sure they have an idea, but they have not given any indication to the public yet what they think happened.
Quickly get us updated, too, on this hostile work environment lawsuit. This was from a former IDOC employee.
Right. So a woman who worked for the Idaho Department of Correction for quite a while, she was in their probation and parole department, she sued because she had reported that a coworker with whom she had previously had a relationship with, or perhaps still did at some point, but that he had raped her 3 times over a 2-week period. She said that the Department of Correction Administration showed support to her coworker, saying, we hope you can return soon, and emails and things like that, did not show her the same support. He was put on paid administrative leave. She continued working. She sued for a hostile work environment under the Civil Rights Act, and she won. So a jury awarded her $1.8 million for emotional distress and damages. She filed a lawsuit under the 1991 Civil Rights Act, which was basically an amendment to the big Civil Rights Act of 1964, right? Making it illegal to discriminate based on gender and race and all of those things, religion. But the amendment in 1991 that allowed women to sue for emotional damages for discrimination included a cap of $300,000 for the maximum award for that. And so while the jury found that she was entitled to this larger award, and they believe the facts in trial proved that, the judge Idaho Department of Corrections said, hey, this actually violates federal law. She can only get $300,000.
And so the judge had to
reduce it. So that's where we're at now.
Okay. I want to leave on a happier note. George, let's talk about the new season of the Idaho Shakespeare Festival before we wrap this up.
Tonight, first performance.
Really? Tonight?
Tonight. I'm not sure if the weather will hold out.
Yeah.
But if you look at last year, which was an historic year for the festival as far as audiences, et cetera. And
you had Mamma Mia last year.
Well,
come on now.
But also Pride and Prejudice was nearly sold out, et cetera. So their season tickets are at an all-time high. A number of performances are already near sold out. They haven't even started yet. But when you look at the season, and some of it is just flat-out fun, The Music Man or Witness for the Prosecution, but the two Shakespeare productions, and one which opens tonight, and that is Taming of the Shrew, and in the Me Too era, you can look at that through all kinds of lenses, and not many of them are pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And then number two, they're doing Julius Caesar. And in today's political climate, a play about how power corrupts, and there was a pretty controversial production of Julius Caesar just a couple of years ago in New York that set President Trump all a Twitter, and I mean that literally. there will be lots of conversation about that. So all of a sudden, things like Shakespeare matters.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
And I should note, George is going to be filling in for me starting next Thursday.
What?
And you're going to—I know you are. Didn't get the memo on that? You'll be here for a while.
My turn? Did you go through the phone book?
Exactly, I did. But you're going to be interviewing the folks at the Idaho Shakespeare Festival more on this and why they chose the plays they chose and what that means. So make sure you join George next Friday for that.
Can George interview Garth Brooks about why he's having a second concert in Idaho?
I think so.
Okay.
I mean, if anyone can get that interview, it's George.
That's Governor Emeritus.
Honorary Governor.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. I want to thank you all for coming in today. My guests, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press, George Prentice with the Boise Weekly, and Bill Manny with Idaho Public Television. This is Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette.